Welcome to Morphus. I'm your host, Andrea Donsky, a nutritionist for more than 16 years who's in menopause. I'm a menopause educator and avid menopause researcher, and I'm passionate about sharing information about perimenopause and menopause so that you can empower yourselves as you enter into this phase of life. Today, I'm interviewing Dr. Jason Fung, a physician, kidney specialist, researcher, and New York Times bestselling author currently practicing in Toronto, Canada. His books, including The Obesity Code, The Complete Guide to Fasting, The Diabetes Code, and The Cancer Code, have challenged conventional thinking about these diseases, and he introduces dietary strategies to manage them. He's the co-founder of The Fasting Method, which provides the education, tools, and community needed to successfully implement intermittent fasting. Now, here's Dr. Fung. Welcome to Morphus, Dr. Fung.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me here.
I am really excited to have you here because I'm a huge fan of intermittent fasting, and our audience are women in perimenopause and menopause. So I'd love you to start from the very beginning and explain what intermittent fasting is.
Yeah, it's really a very simple concept. So the idea of fasting is really, it's just any time that you're not eating. If you look at it from a physiologic standpoint, your body sort of is either feeding, which means you're eating. And when you're eating, you're taking in sort of food energy, which is calories. Yep. And your body wants to store those calories. So insulin, which is a hormone, goes up when you eat. It stores those calories. So you have to have sort of an equal period of time where your insulin is going to fall, which is the signal that your body should start using those calories that it's stored. So it's a balance there, right? It's a balance between feeding, which is storing calories, and fasting, which is using the calories that you've stored. That's really all it is. And you're supposed to have this natural cycle, which is why you have a word breakfast, break your fast.
Because right.
You're not supposed to eat all the time. If you never fast, then you're just going to be storing calories all the time, which means you're going to gain body fat, because, you know, body fat is really no more or less than a store of those food calories, right? And it all depends on insulin, which is why a lot of people look at the carbohydrates, because certain foods are more fattening than other foods, right? And people say it's all about calories, but it's really not. The body doesn't run on calories. The body runs on hormones. That's what tells the body sort of what to do with the calories, how much to eat, whether you should eat more or eat less. Everything in the human body is run on those hormones, and the fasting is a way to sort of adjust those hormones so that you can lose some of the body weight. And it's really a very simple concept. It's been around a very, very long time. But recently, of course, people had the idea that you should eat constantly to lose weight. And it's like, okay, one, that just doesn't make any sense. It's actually impossible to lose weight while you're actually eating.
Right.
It just doesn't work that way. It's sort of like, you know, you're going to dry off by jumping in the shower, right? It's like, that doesn't make any sense at all. You only lose weight when you're not eating. That's the only way you can do it. So, but it had become very, eat it the minute you get up, never skip breakfast, and don't stop eating until you go to bed. And that's the way to lose weight. It's like, one, that doesn't make any common sense. It doesn't make any physiologic sense. You need to have that period of fasting. And in the old days, your grandmother might say, oh, you need time to digest your food, right? That's really all we're talking about. So I know people who say, oh, fasting is bad for you. Well, if you think fasting is bad for you, then you must think you must eat every single minute of the day, because that's what fasting is. It's just part of that natural cycle. It's especially important as you get older, because, you know, with menopause, perimenopause, and as men get older, because there are changes as well. So, you know, with women, there's a change, but men's testosterone also tends to decline over time, which makes weight loss a lot harder, actually. But because of the changes with age, it's especially important to make sure that we have these periods of fasting so that we can allow our bodies to use the calories that are stored away. That's what body fat is. That's what glucose is. So if you have type 2 diabetes, pre-diabetes, again, that's another way to allow your body to use it. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that it's a completely natural way to do it. Right? There's no drugs involved. They're not doing any sort of weird surgery. It's free. And it's been done for thousands of years. So if there was a problem with fasting, we would have figured it out sort of 2000 years ago, it's ridiculous to think that the human body has no capacity to use the fuel that's stored away on our bodies. Of course, if you're underweight, if you're, you know, if you have very little body fat, for example, then no, it's not the right thing for you. But for most of us in North America who have enough body fat and sometimes too much body fat, then it is a very good solution.
Well, I love that you're saying that it's been around for thousands of years, because I think for a lot of people, they think, oh, it's trendy, it's newer, you know, it's something that we should all try, or maybe not. And that actually leads me to my next question is two things. One, I want you to go into what the benefits are of intermittent fasting from a health standpoint, but also I want you to dispel some myths, because when you're on social media, you hear so many things. Obviously, there's a lot of people who are very pro intermittent fasting, like myself. And then there's people who are, let's say, against it, or who say things that, oh, it doesn't work, or it does this, or it's that. And you alluded to that in the beginning when you just answered my previous question. But I'd love you to get into the details of why should we consider intermittent fasting?
Yeah. So, you know, to get to the point that it's a really old therapy, it's literally the oldest dietary intervention in the book. The ancient Greeks talked about it. So again, we know that it's been something that's been done for a very, very long time. The reason that's important is because you know that other people have done it without any problems. Like if you do a diet, for example, that's never been done before, right? Then, you know, say you come up with some diet of some kind of shake and stuff. Well, nobody's ever done that before. You don't know what the consequences are because you don't have the experience with it. But if you follow a diet that's been around, or a dietary intervention like fasting, which has been around for thousands of years, you know that literally billions of people throughout history have done it. And there just are not that many reports of problems with it, right, given the right circumstances, of course, given that you're trying to lose weight, you have to get adequate body fat and so on. So it's not a fad diet. I mean, people say, yeah, it's trendy, it's fatty, right? And with the implication that it's just going to go away.
Right.
But exactly. It's not, because it's been around so long. So there's so many benefits of fasting, because one, from a sort of medical standpoint, it's important because, you know, there's two big issues in today's population, is that you get a lot of these chronic diseases. So the two biggest killers of sort of North Americans is cancer and heart disease. And if you look at the risk factors for those sort of chronic diseases, one of the very, very big risk factors is obesity, and another one is type 2 diabetes. So if you think about how the body stores excess energy, which is calories, it stores it either as sugar or it stores it as body fat. If you have too much sugar, you have type 2 diabetes. If you have too much body fat, you have obesity. So if you have too much of this, then the natural solution is to let your body use some of the fuel that it's stored away. So burn off some of the glucose, burn off some of the body fat, and then you will get better, which is going to decrease your risk of the two, by far and away, biggest health issues of today, which is heart disease and cancer. So we know, of course, that cancer is there's lots of different types of cancer, but many types of cancer are obesity related. That is how they're classified. There's, I think, 13 or 14 different types of cancer that are classified as obesity associated cancers by the World Health Organization. And that includes breast cancer and colorectal cancer, which are sort of the biggest two. The biggest one actually is lung cancer, but that's mostly related to smoking. So that's one of the huge, huge benefits, because a lot of the diseases that we face are related to obesity, type 2 diabetes, and metabolic disease. But there's a lot of other benefits, right? There's, it's a free intervention. It's been used for many, many years. It doesn't take extra time. So, you know, you don't eat, you don't have to shop, you don't have to clean up. So you're actually saving time. Right. You're simplifying your life, because it's not something that you're doing, it's something that you're not doing, right? So it's completely opposite from a diet, which is that the diet tells you what foods are you going to eat. Fasting works with any diet, because it doesn't tell you what foods you should and shouldn't eat. It just tells you that there's a period of time that you need to set aside that you're not eating to digest your food or to use some of the food that you stored away. So whether you're vegan or paleo or carnivore or keto or whatever you want, you know, cabbage soup if you want, but it's whatever diet you want to do. So whether you eat a traditional American diet or a traditional, you know, Indian diet or traditional Chinese diet, it's still going to be the same. And that's a huge benefit. It's also very flexible. That is, you can do it and you cannot do it. You can do more of it if you want to and less of it if you don't want to. If it's on holidays, you don't want to do it, but then you do more after the holidays to make up for it. So completely flexible. And it's powerful because if you don't eat, you're going to lose weight. So people have fasted for, you know, days on end and done very well. The thing about diets is that suppose you decide you're going to be a vegan and you want to lose weight. But you're not losing weight. Well, you can't be more vegan than vegan, or you can't be more Mediterranean than Mediterranean,
right?
Or, you know, whatever you are, or more paleo than paleo. There's a limit there. But with fasting, there's no limit because you can just continue to fast until you lose that weight. So you know that at some point you're going to lose the weight, which gets us sort of, so there's a huge number of benefits, you know, and then there's a lot of myths that go around it. And people try and tell you shouldn't do it for certain reasons. And some of these are very, it's funny because they're almost the exact opposite. So one of them, one of the sort of persistent myths is that it's going to put you into starvation mode, which is this idea that your body is going to shut down when you don't eat.
Right.
And it's actually completely untrue. In fact, it's the opposite. When you don't eat, your body actually doesn't shut down. It actually ramps itself up. And the reason for this is that as your hormone insulin goes down, remember, so when you eat, insulin goes up, tells your body to store calories. When you don't eat, insulin goes down, your body tells itself to liberate those calories. So taking, you know, instead of storing glucose and storing fat, it's going to take glucose and it's going to take fat. It's going to turn it back into blood sugar so that you have energy. The thing is that one of the hormone system that gets revved up during that time is the sympathetic nervous system, which is noradrenaline. So you're actually increasing stimulation to your body. You're going to have more energy. It's just going to come from a different source. It's not going to come from food. It's going to come from your body fat or your blood sugar, right? But you're going to have more energy because that's what your hormones are telling you to do. And you can see this so you're going to get increased concentration. So again, one of the myths is that, well, I have to work. I have to eat. No, you don't have to eat. You can concentrate just fine not eating. And people are just going to say they're tired, but you're going to have more energy. We see it all the time. People actually have so much energy. Sometimes they can't even sleep properly because they're so their body's just sort of flooded with energy. And if you think about it, it makes sense. If you think about Thanksgiving, you had a huge Thanksgiving meal. Do you feel all that energetic or do you just want to lie on the couch and watch TV, right? Because that's what your body is doing. Once you've had that huge meal, you're trying to store it away, right? You're not trying to use it. If you look at animals, you look at a lion who just ate, it's just sort of lying there, not very interested. Or you look at the hungry wolf who hasn't eaten. Is he lethargic and falling down? Not at all.
No.
He's got so much energy and he's zeroed in and focused because that's how he's going to get food. So those myths that, oh, you know, you're going to go into starvation mode is the opposite. When they do a study of people fasting for 4 days, so they looked at the amount of energy, the amount of calories that these people were burning. People say, oh, you're going to go into starvation mode, meaning your body's going to burn less calories. When you actually measure it, so you measure people at day zero, and then you give them no food for 4 days, then you measure how much energy they're burning. The amount of calories that they burn in a day goes up by about 10%. So before they did the fasting, they're burning 2,000 calories. As they fasted for 4 days, at the end of those 4 days, they were burning 2,200 calories per day. So more calories per day, which is obviously a huge advantage if you are trying to lose body fat, because it means that that's where it's coming from. So the second myth is that, you know, you're going to be tired, you know, you can't concentrate. And that's also false. The third myth is that you're going to lose muscle mass. And this one always seems strange to me because, you know, people talk about muscle mass and eating like there's this very tight correlation, but there's not. So just remember, how much muscle you have depends on how much you exercise that muscle, okay? Again, assuming that you're not malnourished and are protein deficient. If we could just eat and build muscle, hey, I'd love it, but it doesn't work like that. If you don't exercise, it matters very little what you eat because you're not going to gain muscle mass or muscle strength, because that's, you know, the body only gets stronger when you exercise it. So you could send people up to space where they have no gravity. There's no, you know, they're not exercising. They lose muscle mass extremely quickly. Mm-hmm. That's why they have to exercise in space, right? It's not what they ate. Like, it's great if I could just eat more and gain muscle. And the opposite is also true. If you don't eat, your body doesn't automatically lose muscle, because, you know, there's this idea that your body is just so incredibly stupid that your body's going to store energy as glucose and fat. And when you need it, the minute you need it, you're going to burn muscle.
Right.
Like, how does that even work? Why would you think the human body is so incredibly stupid that we became the dominant species of this planet? Right. Like, wouldn't you, like, why would you do that? It's like storing firewood for the winter, and then as soon as it gets cold, you chop up your sofa and throw it in the fire. Why would you do that? You know, protein, muscle is functional tissue. It's not a store of energy, right? So when you need a store of energy, you go into your stores of energy, which is glucose and body fat. So that's another myth. And it's usually aimed at getting people to not fast. And of course, you know, those are the main myths. There's a whole lot of others. You know, the one, one that often gets people is the hunger, because you will get hungry during fasting. That is unavoidable. What people always worry about is that they'll get so hungry that they won't be able to control themselves. And for most people, it actually doesn't work that way. For most people, when you miss a meal, your hunger will go up. And then if you don't eat, it'll just go back down. So when they measure, people over 24 hours who haven't eaten, they measure their ghrelin, which is a hormone.
Hunger
that
hormone.
Goes up. Yes, yeah, hunger hormone. So it goes up, you're more hungry. What happens is that, you know, at 12 o'clock, you miss your meal, you're hungry. Yeah. At 4 o'clock, your hunger level, your ghrelin levels are actually the same as if you ate. It goes right back to baseline. So what happened? Well, your body took the energy from your stores. It took it from your body fat, and you ate lunch from your body fat. You just didn't take it from the food. But your body has essentially fed itself on its body fat. So therefore, you're no longer hungry. And that's basically all that happened. So if you can simply ignore it for, you know, 90 minutes or so, that wave of hunger is just going to pass. Your body will feed itself. And most of it is also conditioning. So most of the hunger is actually just conditioning. That is, you think you've got a habit of eating a certain way. And when you don't, then you're going to be hungry. For a lot of people, and you see that because you see these peaks in ghrelin exactly at breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So if you simply train yourself to eat two meals a day, and for years I did this because I skipped breakfast, mostly because I just was too tired and I wanted to sleep, so I didn't want to get up and make breakfast. Right. So I just ate lunch and dinner. I don't get hungry in the morning very often anymore because I'm just not used to it, right?
Yeah, you're so conditioning yourself.
Yeah, it's just a conditioned response. So hunger is very often a conditioned response. So if you simply get used to it, then all of a sudden, you don't have to fight yourself to lose weight because your habits are just going to lead you naturally to this. So that's the beauty of something like fasting, because as soon as you establish that habit, it's easy because it doesn't take any willpower or thought. It's just something that you naturally fall into, as opposed to sort of diets where you're constantly thinking about, should I do this? Should I do this? Should I eat this? No, this you shouldn't eat. So, you know, there's a lot of advantages there. A lot of the myths turn out to be false. In fact, most of the myths are the exact opposite. So people say, oh, you can't concentrate. You know, your concentration actually is shown to be better. It's like, oh, you're going to go into starvation mode, meaning that your body will burn less energy. No, it actually burns more energy. So all of these myths are just blown away by the actual science of it, which nobody had bothered to look at. So when I started talking about this in sort of 10 years ago, 8 years ago almost, all the science was there already. But the perception, which is that this fasting is bad for you, fasting is dangerous, fasting is going to cause all these things, it was almost all the exact opposite of what was actually true. And it just meant getting the knowledge out there and people could see it for themselves. Hey, here's an intervention that's free, that's available, that has all these benefits, and most of the myths are simply untrue. So what's stopping us from doing it? And the answer is nothing. It's just habits. We want to change our habits.
And I think when you first start doing it, you might, like you were saying, it's conditioning. So you're going to be hungrier until your body adapts. And then eventually you're not. I mean, I've been doing it for so long that sometimes I look at my watch and it's like 1 o'clock. I'm like, oh my gosh, I haven't even eaten and I'm not hungry. So I want to dive into actually some of the specifics about the different types of fasts. And then I want to talk about weight loss. You've talked about it quite a bit and you've alluded to it, but I want to dig deep into it because weight loss, brain health, sleep, kind of everything, as we're going into perimenopause and menopause, we're experiencing all these symptoms. And I want to know how intermittent fasting can help. But let's start first in terms of the type of fast that we can do. So we know that there's the 16-8 or there's the 12-12 or there's the OMAD or there's the alternate day fasting. Can you talk about the different types of fasting for those who are newer to intermittent fasting?
Yeah, so there's really only two sort of variables that fast differ. One is the length of the fast. So you can do it for 12 hours, or you can do it for 16 hours, or you can do it for 24 hours, or you can do it for 24 days if you feel like it, right? So the body goes through certain stages. I did do a whole video on this on YouTube called The 5 Stages of Intermittent Fasting. And during those stages, you sort of go through different phases so that at one point you're burning more glucose, and then you get into the stage of sort of gluconeogenesis, where you are burning some protein, not necessarily muscle, but protein. And that's important because of this whole idea of autophagy and how it's actually considered to be highly beneficial. And then you get into sort of fat burning. So depending on what your specific goal is, you may do more shorter or longer fast. So you get into this range sort of at the beginning where you start burning glucose mostly, then you get into this sort of autophagy, 24 to 36 hours. And then after that, you get into mostly fat oxidation, which means if you're looking for that, you can use longer fast for losing body fat. It gets into this sort of protein sparing sort of fat burning mode, because again, your body wants to change most of its energy requirements to body fat. So the length of the fast is one variable. And the other thing to think about for fast length is how you're going to implement that into a regular day. Because if you do long fasts, I'll tell you that they're not easy to fit into a regular daily schedule.
And can you be like clear what you mean by a long fast?
Yeah. So if you're going more than 24 hours, so if you're doing, say, a 3-day fast, it's not all that easy to fit it in, because a lot of people have dinner with family or they have plans to go out and socialize. And socialization is often at dinner time, right? Or after meals or after drinks or whatever. And the idea is not to be a hermit and, you know, lock yourself away, because that's very unhealthy as well, you know. So you want to sort of fit the fasting into your lifestyle, not fit your lifestyle into fasting. So therefore, if you choose a sort of long fasting schedule, then that's going to sort of play havoc on your rest of your life, which is not the point of this, right? It's supposed to make your life easier, not harder. Right. So that's why a lot of the shorter fasts are so much easier to do, because they fit into the regular day so much easier. So 16-8, for example, so the shorter you do a fast, generally the more frequently you're going to do it. So a 16-hour fast is just eating in 8 hours of the day. And so you're, you know, allowing yourself 16 hours to use that. So you might eat from, say, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. And that fits very easily into a normal working schedule. It still allows you to have sort of dinner with your family every night, go out for dinner with friends on the weekends and all that kind of thing. Because most of the time, people don't care if you eat breakfast or not. They're not expecting you there. And, you know, because remember, when social. You eat.
Yeah,
there's very little social aspect to it. And as opposed to dinner, which is a, you know, meals are not just for sustenance, they're also a time for us to connect with others and sit Absolutely. Down and spend time, right? So that's why you have to all take that into consideration. So a 16-8 schedule or a one meal a day schedule works extremely well with that. So one meal a day is where you might eat, say, dinner every, you know, today to dinner the next day, which is about a 24-hour fast. So those are the most popular because they, so 16-8 and one meal a day or OMAD, those are the two most popular schedules because they fit into a normal day without too much sort of adjusting of other things. And you don't have to, if you're doing one meal a day, it's not that you have to do it every day. You might do it a couple of times a week, for example. So the point is that, you know, that's a lot easier. The second way fasts differ is mostly what's allowed during the fast. So a classic fast is water only, but there's a lot of other variations that allow other things. So if you allow, for example, tea and coffee, that's not actually a classic sort of water only fast. But if you're just drinking green tea, the effect on weight loss and metabolic health is negligible. So I always tell people to make sure they stay hydrated, they drink it and so on. Some people are even more strict. They do a dry fast, which doesn't even allow water. So you can do that for short periods, less than 24 hours. Some people actually find it easier. Some people find it harder. Certain religious types of fasts are dry fasts. So that's why some people do them. And there's nothing really wrong with them, except that you can't do it for long because you're going to get dehydrated. But if you're keeping to the shorter schedules, then yeah, you might find that easier. Some people do, and you might find it harder, in which case then don't do that. And then there are also those fasts that still allow some food, things like bone broth and even vegetables sometimes, like, you know, a little bit of snacks in here. So Dr. Mosley's 5-2 diet, you know, his fasting days are actually 500 calories a day with no specification of the period of time. So it's not quite a fasting, because fasting is the period of time that you don't eat. He sort of says, well, it's a period of time where you're having very little.
Right.
Fasting mimicking diet is very much the same idea, which is that it's a there are certain foods that are allowed, but very limited, and generally, you know, it's limited the amount of energy, so the calories are low. So both of those are sort of fasting variations. They're not true fast, but fasting mimicking diet and the 5-2 diet are sort of along the same ideas of that diet.
Now, should we be changing it up? So let's say for the average woman who's in perimenopause and menopause, they're like, she wants to take control of her symptoms. She wants to lose weight. She wants to feel better. She wants to reap all those health benefits. From what I'm understanding or what I'm hearing you say is that there are many different ways that we can do a fast, and the ones that are the easiest are the ones that we can have dinner and be more sociable with our family. Would you say that it's a good idea to change it up? Like one day do 12-12, then another day do 16-8, another day do OMAD. And are there health benefits for that?
I do recommend changing it up occasionally. So there's two things. One is that it's good to establish a pattern first, because by establishing the pattern, you build the habit, which then makes it easy. So then you no longer have to think about it. So for example, cutting out snacks and skipping breakfast is an easy one, because it's once you build that into the habit, you no longer have to think about it, worry about it. You don't have to think, am I eating breakfast today? Am I not eating breakfast? You just don't, because that's just the way you do. And it makes it easy, because the hunger typically just sort of goes away as well, because your body is used to the fact that you're not eating at, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning or whatever. Right. So you want to first establish the baseline habit. Then if you get into a plateau, so if you're doing well, then there's no reason to switch. If you hit a plateau, which a lot of people do, that's when you want to start changing it up and go a little longer, go a little stricter, change it up in terms of what you're doing to sort of shake your body up a little bit. Because if you get into this sort of steady state where you did lose some weight, it did well, but now it's sort of flatlined, that's when you want to change it up every so often. And so you keep your baseline, but then every so often you throw in some extra stuff so that you shake it up. And it's no different than, say, exercise, where you would do a high intensity workout, for example. If you're sort of flatlined in terms of your progress, you might start doing some sort of interval sprints or whatever like that, right? Just to shake it up so that you get out of that sort of rut that you're in. So changing it up does have some benefits from that standpoint. It's actually quite a an old way to do things. If you think about how people used to do fasting, like from a religious standpoint, they just specified periods of time that, hey, it's Lent or it's Yom Kippur or it's this is a fasting period, okay, or Ramadan. So it's like, okay, you should fast. So every year or every few months, you'd have this sort of communal sort of, okay, we're all going to do this. And that shakes you up for a little while, right? You know, makes you appreciate what you have more and everything like that.
Should you do one day a week where you're not fasting at all? Let's say I'm talking more for like the average person who wants to try it. Should there, you know, so you're saying you don't necessarily have to shake it up, but what about if there's one, let's say on Sunday, you're like, okay, I'm not going to fast today. Today, I'm just going to eat regularly. Is that something that you would recommend?
I think it's doable. It all depends on what your goals are and right, how far along you are. So if you have severe health issues, well, I wouldn't recommend it at first. But, you know, if you're in a place that's good and you're happy with where you are and you want to, say, do a cheat day or whatever, then yeah, it's absolutely, because that's what's going to keep you sort of in tune with the whole program. And remember, fasting is flexible. That is, you don't have to do it every single day exactly the same. You could do none at all on Sunday and then do maybe a bit more on Monday, so that you don't, like, you know, the thing about holidays and these sort of cheat periods, like holidays, you know, Christmas time, that kind of thing, is that most people, when you think about it, don't make up for it. So if you say you eat a certain right, amount, and then you have a period, say Christmas, because that's where traditionally you see the most weight gain. So you eat a lot, like way too much and not the right foods, right? A lot of cookies right, and ice cream and desserts. So that's fine. So you're eating, then you eat a lot. Well, then you go, okay, now it's January 2nd, so I'm going to go back to eating regularly. Well, you never made up for the, right, that period of a month where you ate too much. Like, you have to have a period of a month where you're eating a lot less in order to balance. You can't just go back to your usual. So again, same thing with the cheat days. If you say, okay, well, yeah, and I'm totally fine with it. Say you have a day, I don't want to think about it, where it's a day I'm just not going to think about. I'm going to eat what I feel like eating, and that's it. That's fine. But if you're going to eat more on that day and the wrong foods, then you should have another day that makes up for it, because you can't have a positive day, right? Say you're at 0, 0, 0, and then you're at positive, 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 and then you go back to 0, 0, 0. Well, where was all your negatives that canceled out your positive? You never had those, right? So you can't do that. So the fasting is flexible so that you can do that and then, say, make it up the next day or whatever.
There's a lot of talk around women's cycles and when they shouldn't and shouldn't be fasting. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there's a lot of myths around women and fasting. I mean, we hear this a lot, that women shouldn't fast for whatever reason. And, you know, there's some truth that men and women are different, obviously. But it doesn't mean that women shouldn't fast, because when you think about their digestive systems, their metabolic systems, they're much the same. That is, the way that we process foods and so on is the same. Now, there are certainly differences from a behavioral standpoint and a weight loss standpoint. So a lot of men, for example, will tend to lose weight very quickly at the beginning, whereas women tend to have to go a little bit more slow, like they'll see the more slow progress. But again, it's not something that doesn't work for women ever, which I've seen before. And it's like, because remember, we're talking about the metabolic system, which is, you know, a lot of, you know, insulin and you know, hormones like ghrelin and so on, and there's slight differences between them, but there's not huge differences. So women can still fast. Most of our program is actually women, and they still, some do very well. Some don't do very well, but some men don't do very well too. So it's not like you can do one versus the other. There's certainly differences in psychology, for example. Like, men will do probably better if you put them sort of in a competition with each other, sort of make it a competitive thing. It works better for them, because men are, you know, perhaps they respond better to that. And that's maybe the way they grew up or whatever. But there are differences, but they're not huge differences physiologically. So when you talk about changes in hormones, like estrogen and progesterone. Those are obviously things that only affect women. And they're important, but they're not affected too much by diets and so on. So it's not like something you have to adjust that you can or can't do or should or shouldn't do. You know, the sex hormones play a huge difference in weight management. That's actually quite true. Because if you think about puberty, before puberty, boys and girls are actually very much similar in terms of their weight, in terms of their body fat. After puberty, the boys tend to be very different from the girls because the boys, under the influence of testosterone, tend to gain more muscle. And the girls, under the influence of estrogen and progesterone, tend to gain body fat. So they gain breasts, their hips get bigger. That's just an average over, you know, millions of people. We've known this forever, that boys and girls are different. And boys, through puberty, get more muscular. And so if you look at how much body fat they gain, girls gain about 50% more body fat than the boys. And the main difference is testosterone versus estrogen. And that's why I always think it's so strange that people think it's all about calories, because it's not about calories and willpower. It's not like girls have less willpower and boys have more willpower. You know, it has everything to do with hormones. The body only responds to hormones, not calories. So, you know, there's such a stark difference. And the same thing happens during menopause. There's a lot of people, because of the changes in the estrogen progesterone, they have trouble with the weight gain. You actually see it in studies. The perimenopausal period is actually probably the worst one. It's actually the period leading up to menopause is where you see the weight gain.
And but we have the highest amount of ghrelin when we're in perimenopause. Then we higher ghrelin than we do before and in menopause, which is, actually that was one of my questions I wanted to ask you. So let's get into that actually, because it's really important that we talk about it, because a lot of women feel at this stage that it's their fault that they're gaining weight and because it's important.
Yeah, it is. And then that's where this whole calories discussion is so detrimental, really. I mean, you see all these health and fitness gurus, it's all about calories, with the implication that it's all about willpower. But it's clearly not, because again, the influence of hormones is so significant. That is, you look at puberty, you look at when you give people insulin, they gain weight. It doesn't matter how much willpower you have, you're going to gain weight when I give you insulin. It's a hormonal thing. If your ghrelin levels are high, then you're going to be hungry. You're not eating because you have no willpower. You're eating because you're hungry. So the problem wasn't the calories. The calories was just something for the, you know, gurus to blame you for. Like it's essentially what they like to do is blame the victim. They say, oh, it's your own fault, right? You ate that donut. It's like, well, why were you so hungry? Because your ghrelin levels were high. So women actually tend to have much higher spikes in ghrelin, and the fasting actually impacts them more than the men. So the men tend to have lower spikes of ghrelin and the women tend to have higher spikes. But then over time with fasting, ghrelin actually gets pushed down. So they may actually do better over time. It's not immediate, but over time, the ghrelin tends to come down more because they tended to go higher. So if anything, if you do it consistently, the women may do better over time, especially during that time where ghrelin is such an issue, right? I mean, the whole thing about calories is that you're looking at the sort of just the end result. You're not looking that one step deeper. I always think that people who are so focused on calories, they're so simplistic. They're all like, it's all about calories in, calories out. Well, let's take one step deeper. Okay. Why are you eating more calories? Because you're hungry. Well, you can't choose to be less hungry. You can't choose to be more hungry. And why is your calories out, which is metabolic rate, low? Right? It's not exercise. Most of your metabolic rate is your heart, your lungs, your kidneys, right? It's all about metabolic rate. You can't choose your metabolic rate. So these people who say it's all about calories, they're implying that it's all about willpower. It's all about what you choose. You can't choose to be more hungry. You can't choose your metabolic rate to go up or down. You have to influence the hormones that influence the hunger, right? Yep. So that's the whole
point. Well said.
Yeah. And that's why I think this whole calories in, calories out discussion, which I'll tell you that most of academic medicine believes in to their very core, right, is very harmful for people, because what they're saying is actually that obesity weight gain is all your fault, right?
Exactly.
That's the message that gets out there, but it's not true. It's like the hormones are all messed up. So let's fix the hormones, not, you know, you're eating too many calories, you have no willpower, which is what most people are saying, right? And that's where all the negativity comes in. You know, they talk about body positivity and stuff, right? The negativity comes from these calories in, calories out people. And I don't know why.
Eat less and exercise more. And I can't even tell you how, and that's the what a lot of women in perimenopause and menopause are saying. I have a TikTok page and I get hundreds and hundreds of comments from women that are being told that by their healthcare professional. It's, you know, it's your fault, or they won't even talk to them until they lose weight, or they need to eat less, exercise more. I mean, it is so detrimental. It is body shaming. It makes me really sad when I hear it, but
I hear it over and over too. And I always think that those people actually think they're right too, like the healthcare professionals and a lot of influencers on social media and so on.
Yeah. Oh, the whole calorie deficit thing.
Yeah.
I want you, please, can you talk about that? Because another thing that it's just over and over again, we hear. So please.
Over and over again. The whole calorie deficit thing is so stupid. it really is, because it's like, if you think about it, the entire idea of calorie deficits is just this giant piece of circular logic, right? Because it's like, okay, so this is what they say. It's in order to lose weight, you have to eat less than you burn. Okay. And they say, oh, that's obvious, right? Well, how do you know you're eating less than you're burning? It's like, because you're gaining weight, right? Well, that's just circular logic. You're defining the problem in itself, right? So, because you don't know how much you should eat, because you eat different than I do, than everybody else does. Everybody eats a certain amount, right? So you're saying that you have to eat less than you burn, but how do you know you're eating too much, right? So you see what I'm saying, right? They're saying that you're getting fat because you're eating too much. Well, how do you know you're eating too much? Because you're getting fat. Well, okay, so A causes B, B causes A. That's circular logic. That is classic circular logic. And that's why people believe it, because it's like, you're gaining weight because you're eating too much. We know you're eating too much because you're gaining weight. There's actually no logic in there at all. It's a classic logical fallacy. But if you repeat it over and over, people believe it's true. Yeah. So the whole idea of this calorie deficit is that your body is going to burn a certain amount. Okay, so that's your metabolic rate, and you're eating a certain amount, and that's, you know, the number of calories you eat. The idea is that you should simply eat less calories, which can be balanced by two things. So first of all, there's never a calorie deficit, because the energy balance equation, which says body fat equals calories in minus calories out, right, is a balanced equation. There's no deficit anywhere. You have to balance the two sides. So there's three variables. You have body fat, which is a store of calories, right? You have energy in, energy out, calories in, calories out there. So there's three variables that can change. Suppose you reduce your calories in. So that's one of the variables. It's possible that you could lose body fat. That could balance the equation. But it's equally possible that you could simply reduce the energy you expend. That will also balance the equation, right? That is to say, say you eat 2000 calories, you burn 2000 calories, your body fat stores are stable. Now you want to lose weight. You go to 1500 calories in, and the calories in, calories people say, for sure that's going to work. It almost never works, because there's two possible ways you can balance the equation. So you're eating 1500. You could either continue to burn 2000 and lose body fat. Yes, you could. That almost never happens. In practice, in real life, and in every single study, scientific study we've done over the last 50 years, what happens is that you eat 1500, your body burns 1500, and your body fat stays the same. Actually, it's even worse than that, because what the studies show is that, so from going from 2000 and stable, you eat 1500, your body actually drops your expenditure to 1400. Then you start to gain weight. So you lose weight initially for 6 months. As your body adapts, your metabolic rate goes down to 1400, you're eating 1500 and gaining weight. And then people say, well, you must be gaining weight because you're cheating on your diet. You're not cheating on your diet. It's because you've dropped your energy expenditure so low. We know that happens. Every single study we've done shows that that is what happens. And yet this is what people tell you, eat less. It just doesn't work, because what you've done is you haven't created the conditions necessary to use the body fat. Remember, what you want to do is to, if you have 2,000 calories in, 2,000 calories out, body fat as a store, right? So it's like, imagine this. Say you go to the grocery store, you get food, you eat some food, and you put whatever stored into the fridge, right? So if you, all of a sudden, so you're going three times a day to buy food, you store some, you eat some, it's all in balance. Now, all of a sudden, you don't go to a store, so there's nothing to eat, but your fridge is locked. Well, what do? Well, you can't burn anything. You can't use anything, right?
Yep.
That's the same thing with insulin. If insulin is high, then you can't access your body fat stores. So if you eat constantly and you're eating low fat, high carb foods, insulin is high, you can't access your body fat stores. Okay, so now you look at those three variables. Body fat stores is locked away. You can't get at that.
Yep.
You reduce your calories into 1,500. The only way you can balance this equation is to reduce your calories out to 1,500. So now what happens is that you used to burn 2,000. Now you're burning 1,500. You're cold, you're tired, you're hungry, and you're gaining weight. What you want to do is unlock the calories that are available in your fat stores, so that you can eat 1,500, you can continue to burn 2,000, and that 500 is coming out from there. The only way you can do that is get your insulin levels down so that you can get access to that. And that's what I mean. You have to understand, what is it that's keeping us high? So this old idea from 10 years ago that you should eat sort of super low fat, super low cal, and eat 10 times a day. It was exactly the wrong thing.
The opposite.
It was the exact opposite for losing weight. You need to get your energy out from the body fat. That's what you're trying to do. Not eat less. You're just trying to get those stores out. And the only way you can do that is to create the hormonal conditions that allows it to do that. I go over all that in one of the videos. It's actually a longer lecture on YouTube, which is like a 50-minute lecture on that exact process of how it works.
Okay, I can link to those below if you want to give me the name of those after, then I'll put them below so people can go and listen to it. And that, by the way, was the explanation and the difference between calorie deficit and intermittent fasting. And because I think a lot of people who argue about it will say, well, intermittent fasting is the same thing as calorie deficit because you're eating in a smaller window, so you're not going to be eating the same. So maybe just kind of explain that and debunk that myth that they're the same thing.
Yeah. So both can create a calorie deficit. What's important is to create the hormonal conditions that allows you to use your body fat. So if you eat 1500 calories constant throughout the day versus sort of once a day, then the rest of the day, your insulin levels are going to go down during intermittent fasting. Your insulin levels go down. Your body now gets the signal, hey, I should start pulling calories back out from body fat. So as you do that, you can make up the other 500 calories that you're missing. If you're just taking 1500 calories constantly throughout the day, insulin levels stay high, your body never gets the signal that, hey, you can start taking out your calories. Well, if you only have 1,500 coming in and you don't have anything coming out from your body, you can only burn 1,500. That's how your metabolic rate goes down from 2,000 calories to 1,500 calories. And that's the difference between fasting and just pure calorie restriction. Even though both are the same number of calories, you're trying to make sure that it's the hormones that are fixed. And that's that video I was talking about. I think it's called The Science of Intermittent Fasting or something like that. It was a longer lecture that was on YouTube.
And the other thing that drives me absolutely crazy when we're talking about calories is, and when it comes to calorie deficit, is that all calories are not created equal, or in that case, they're like, okay, so take, you know, if you're eating your calories and have artificial sweeteners, and it doesn't matter what you're eating, you know, and you're trying to just get that calorie deficit because you're so they're so focused on calories that it doesn't matter what you're eating. And the food that you could be eating are filled with artificial ingredients and chemicals and artificial sweeteners. Yeah. And it's so frustrating because not all calories are created equal. And again, I wrote a book called Unjunk Your Junk Food in 2011. So I do not focus on calories. For me, it's all about ingredients and what's in our food and understanding that and focusing on whole foods. But, you know, it's really, can you talk about that? Because a lot of women who are trying to lose weight will say, okay, well, I'm going to drink that diet drink, that diet soda instead, or have that diet Jello instead, because that, you know, will allow me to lose the weight. What happens when we consume, let's focus on artificial sweeteners. What happens with insulin when we consume them?
Yeah. So when you take artificial sweeteners, you're getting that signal, that sweetness. And sometimes that's going to raise insulin. Certain ones like aspartame used to do it a lot, but some other newer ones actually don't do it that much. But the problem is that that sweetness is going to tell your body, hey, you know, we're going to eat. So then you get hungry. So it's like, okay, so on the one hand, there's no calories coming in, but on the other hand, your body is getting ready to eat. And so therefore your insulin's going to go up. You're going to, again, lock away the fat stores, because, you know, that signal is telling your body food's going to come in. I'm going to start storing calories as opposed to burning calories, right? Yeah. Your body is either storing it or it's burning it. There's no other in between. So it gets ready to start storing calories because that's what you've just told it to do. And therefore, if your insulin's still going up, then your body's not able to use those calories. And then you're going to want to eat because you're going to be hungry. And that's going to lead you to do a lot worse. And you know, you think about it, like you just have to use some common sense. Like how many people have ever told you that, hey, I just switched to Diet Coke, lost 25 pounds. It's like, no, I don't think I've ever heard that, ever. What you do hear a lot of is, hey, I was drinking like 20 Diet Pepsis a day. As soon as I got off that junk, I lost 25 pounds, right? Because it was all that chemical that was keeping you sort of in that sort of feeding mode as opposed to that fasting mode, right? And the thing about the calories, again, is just so stupid too. I can't believe
eloquently said. I like that, Dr. Fung.
Because calories is a unit of food energy. And you get this people who say a calorie is a calorie, calorie is a calorie. Okay, so the minute you eat calories, so say you take 100 calories of cookies versus 100 calories an egg, for example. The minute you put those in your mouth, the hormonal response to those two foods is completely and utterly different. And that's not in dispute. We know that certain foods are going to spike insulin. The cookies are going to spike insulin like crazy. The egg is not going to.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen? So you spike insulin, your body takes that 100 calories and it takes a super high insulin and says, oh, I need to put all this into fat because it's a storage form. So I take these 100 calories of cookies, I store it into fat. Well, there's no energy for your rest of your body. So you're going to want to continue to eat because you need energy for the rest of your body. You take that egg, insulin doesn't go up. Your body uses the energy, right? Then you're not going to want to eat. So you're going to get full. You're going to get satiety. You're going to want to not eat. And your body is not going to be storing it because it's using it, right? So that 100 calories, your body has two choices. You can use it or you can burn it. Burn it or you can store it, right? So which one it does makes a huge difference to how much body fat you store. So it's all about not the number of calories, it's about what the hormonal response to those calories is, which is completely and utterly different between two foods.
Yes.
So why would you say that they're the same? Why are cookies the same as an egg? Who gets fat eating spinach and broccoli, right? But there's a lot of people who get fat eating cookies. So calories are not the same. So people say a calorie is a calorie. It's like, that's so stupid. I never asked you if a calorie is a calorie. I'm asking you, are calories equally fattening? So the only implication is that certain foods are more fattening than other foods, right? Cookies are more fattening than broccoli. That's all I'm saying. Is that common sense? Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, your grandmother would have told you that if you think cookies are as fattening as broccoli, you're stupid, right? There's no way you're right. Cookies are more fattening. That's all that we're saying here, which is pure common sense. and something everybody used to know, right? You go back in time, people wanted to lose weight. They didn't say, oh, you should eat less vegetables,
right?
Right? Because that's stupid. Vegetables aren't that fattening. So, right. But that's what we say now. We say, oh, well, you could skip your salad and eat ice cream because that's the same number of calories. So therefore it's a calorie is a calorie. It's like, no, those calories are very fattening because your body responds to it by storing them as fat. And these calories, your body responds to it. Insulin doesn't go up. You know, there's other hormones. There's peptide YY, for example.
I was just going to ask you about the satiety hormones. So what are the foods that we should be focusing on in perimenopause and menopause that are going to increase that those satiety hormones? So, yeah, so it's please be, segue.
Yeah, so it's going to be, so if you look at satiety, it's very interesting because it tells you what you need to know. There are certain hormones that when you eat it, you get full. Okay, so peptide YY responds to proteins. Cholecystokinin responds to fat, and there's also stomach stretch receptors. So if you eat foods that are sort of high in protein and fat, right, and most protein foods and fat foods sort of go together as opposed to carbohydrates, then you're going to get full and you're going to know when to stop eating. You can't just keep eating those foods. It's like when you're completely full. Say you had a big Thanksgiving dinner and somebody says, hey, why don't you eat another pork chop? It's like you're nauseous. You're like, I can't eat that. That's the same pork chop you happily ate like, you know, an hour earlier. It's the same food. It's that your hormones are like, your satiety hormones are ramped up. Peptide YY cholecystokinin. So proteins and fats, you're going to get full. You're going to naturally stop eating and you're not going to want more, which is great because if you don't want it, it's very easy to not eat it. Carbohydrates in their natural form contain a lot of fiber and they're generally very bulky. So they're going to fill up your stomach. Your stomach is going to stretch. You activate stretch receptors in the stomach and you're going to stop eating. The problem is that when you start taking carbohydrates that are highly refined, like flour or fruit juice, you take out all the pulp, you take out all the other stuff, you take out all the protein, you take out all the fat, right? That's what you do when you take wheat and turn it into flour. There's no fat, there's no protein. It's all of like pure carbohydrate. But you no longer get the stretch in the stomach and therefore you don't get the satiety. So you can keep eating those foods. Whereas if you were to eat beans or something like, you know, vegetables, which have some carbohydrates, but have a lot of bulk, you're going to naturally stop. So in nature, when you eat natural foods, even carbohydrate-containing foods, you're going to know when to stop because your stomach is full, as opposed to refined carbohydrates. And again, it's just pure common sense. Like when you're completely full and somebody says, can you, you want to eat another pork chop? You say, no, no way. Somebody says, do you want a cookie? You're like, sure, no problem. You know, as kids, you say, oh, I had a second stomach for that.
You always have room for dessert, right? It's always like, I'm so full, but I have room for dessert. I can go.
Exactly. Because there's no satiety there. So there's a huge difference. And again, it just comes down to the hormones. So if you're going to eat foods, then make sure you eat natural foods because natural foods we've adapted to, we have ways of knowing how much we should eat and how much and when we should stop, as opposed to sort of, you know, if you want fruit juice, you can always, even after you feel completely full, you still get fruit juice and still put it down because there's almost no satiety effect there, right? I used to wonder about that because when I was a kid, I used to think, hey, that's very strange that you could have, you know, a full meal and then you could just have a Coke afterwards or, and it could be 500 calories, but hey, you don't feel it at all. Like, strange because you should not want it because you're completely full. But there's a difference in those calories. That's why when people say a calorie is so stupid and so misleading. And again, it's all those calories in, calories out people because they don't understand that it's really about the hormones. In this case, the satiety hormones that are so important in telling you that you should stop eating and you're bypassing that entire safety mechanism. And that's why you're gaining weight. And that's why things like, you know, the sweeteners, artificial sweeteners, refined foods is very bad for you. You can eat carbohydrate containing foods very easily, like, but if they're in their natural state, you're going to know sort of when to do it and when not to do it.
What are your thoughts on fruits and, let's say, complex carbohydrates like sweet potatoes or squash or pumpkin?
So fruits is sort of variable because there's a lot of fructose. Some of it is very sweet. So it's not necessarily your best friend. I don't think it's your worst enemy either, because again, there is a lot of other stuff. So if you're eating an apple or something like that, there's still that bulk and there's still those other things in it, the fiber and so on, that is going to prevent you from overeating it. So if you're taking fruit juice, then yeah, very easy to overeat that, but it's very hard to overeat apples, for example. Same with the complex, and it's more like the root vegetables. So even potatoes, for example, if you have boiled potatoes, it's really hard to overeat boiled potatoes. You just don't really want to. After a while, you just get full. Same with sweet potatoes. So again, not necessarily the best thing, but not necessarily the worst thing either. So it's not necessarily the carbohydrates in it. It's sort of it's all of those things. How do they affect it? How do they affect your satiety and so on? So that's why people used to eat a lot of carbohydrates. And it's a more complex thing, right? People look at China, where people used to eat a lot of rice, for example, and still didn't gain a lot of weight. Well, it's like, well, one, there's a lot of poverty at the time. And two, it was a very monotonous diet. That is, it was white rice and vegetables pretty much every meal for every day of the year. And there's two reasons why you eat. One is that you're hungry and need nourishment. And two is that it's delicious, right? So if you take away the deliciousness, that is, you eat a very monotonous diet. So no matter what you eat, no matter how good it is, if you eat it every single day, it actually starts being not so tasty to you. If you eat white rice and vegetables every single day, pretty soon you only eat until you are full. And after that, you don't want to eat anymore because there's no sort of hedonic enjoyment of it. It's a big difference from now, because now you've got chemicals, you've got, you know, different foods that are going to keep you wanting to eat. And, you know, therefore a lot of people are eating way past their fullness and eating for the enjoyment of it, which is not to minimize it. I mean, everybody enjoys food, but if you're eating every day past that sort of hunger requirements and into enjoyment, well, that's a problem. That's why these monotonous diets often work. So, you know, it's complex. That's what I'm saying. And that's why I always think this whole calories in, calories out crowd, which tries to boil it all down to one single factor that's not even a physiologic factor. That is, the body has no calorie receptors. The body has no idea how many calories you're eating. It's a term from physics, not from physiology. It has actually no implications for physiology whatsoever. So, you know, how people sort of got so sold on it, I don't know. But the problem is, of course, now everybody is so into it. They think that, oh, that must be the right thing. It's a lot more complicated than that. And so trying to push this simple idea of just a calorie is a calorie, it's like, well, what about the hormonal response to the calorie? It's completely irrelevant. Like, is that what you're telling me?
That's the question we need to be asking. And which actually leads me to my next question is for those who are, let's say, newer, or those who are seasoned intermittent fasters, should we be going to our doctors and asking to get specific blood tests? Like, we know there's the A1C, we know the fasting glucose, fasting insulin, which is something that a lot of people aren't aware of, or it's not routinely, advised by their doctors to get. What do you recommend that, again, I'm speaking to women in menopause and perimenopause, that we should go and ask our doctor to test us for?
The blood tests, the fasting insulin is quite variable. That's the problem. So it will go up and down a lot. And I used to test it, but it was just so variable that you couldn't really make a heads or tails of it, really.
And is it A1C time of day? Sorry to interrupt you. Is it time of day?
It's usually done, well, it changes during the day. So you always do it fasting. I mean, even the fasting level would be like, today is this and tomorrow is completely different. And so it wasn't as useful as you think that it could be.
Okay.
So in the end, it winds up boiling down to clinical factors. That is, you know, mostly in terms of watching your diet, you'll still see it in terms of waist circumference and weight and so on.
So when we think about insulin, and you're mentioning carbohydrates and ultra processed foods and all of these foods that are affecting it, are there other variables that affect insulin? For example, autoimmunity. let's say that you have Hashimoto's or some type of autoimmune disorder, can that have an effect on our ghrelin, our leptin, as well as our insulin and our fasting glucose?
Autoimmunity, not so much. So Hashimoto's and thyroid disease does affect. So thyroid disease in general can cause, if your thyroid level's too low, then that's going to affect your metabolic rate, which is going to affect your weight gain overall. But the diet, and sometimes it does help with intermittent fasting, although for a different reason. Sometimes it's the fasting helps with the autoimmunity. That is, it sort of resets the immune system in some cases. So some people actually notice that their thyroid gets much better with fasting, although generally those two hormones don't interact with each other a lot. Where you do see other factors, though, are very interesting things like meal order, for example. If you eat the carbs first versus eating the carbs last, makes a big difference to how high your sugars go and how high your insulin spikes. The other thing is that's I thought very interesting is the vinegar and acid. If you take acid with carbohydrates, it makes tends to make a big difference in terms of, again, glucose and insulin for a different reason. So, you know, if you take vinegar, for example, with rice, which is what sushi rice has, then the glycemic effect of it is actually much less than just taking the rice alone. And it's for, and again, a very interesting reason, which I went into in a different video, but it does work. So fermented foods can do that. So that's, and these are acidic foods. So fermented foods is lactic acid, vinegar is acetic acid, and lemon juice, lime juice is citric acid. All of them will have that same effect and can be used for that reason. So adding fermented foods is actually a way that may help.
And that'll help too. I interviewed Carol Johnston. She's a PhD and she had written two papers on vinegar. I'll post that interview below as well. And she was talking about taking vinegar about 10 minutes before you eat a carbohydrate-rich meal. So that's interesting that you're saying that. What are some other tools or tips that we could do in terms of blunting that glucose or insulin spike after we eat?
Those would be the main ones, I think. You know, again, changing up the carbohydrate intake. So when you eat it in a mixed meal, as opposed to eating it first. So they did some studies where they sort of gave protein fat first and then waited 10 minutes, gave carbohydrate versus carbohydrate, wait 10 minutes versus the other. And you see that the eating carbohydrate first is a lot worse. So that's where, you know, avoiding the bread right at the beginning is going to be worse. Take your salad and everything up front and then eat those carbohydrates down towards the end. And that's, you know, that's probably good practice because it's not changing necessarily the foods that you're eating, just the sort of order of the foods.
In your expert opinion, should our glucose and then therefore insulin always be below a certain threshold even after we eat? Is that what where we look at in terms of health benefits? Is that where it should stay?
No, I mean, it's supposed to go up during your meals. That's just a natural thing, but it shouldn't go up too high and it shouldn't go too low. It almost rarely these days with the problem of obesity go too low, but the too high is mostly due to the refining of foods. So refined carbohydrates and very pure carbohydrates, that is taking it alone without anything else, is a problem, which of course we did at before when people were eating low fat diets, you'd eat like slices of white bread with jam sort of thing, which is almost pure carbohydrate as opposed to eating it with an egg or with bacon or whatever it is.
Dr. Fung, one more question before we end today's interview. What is the ideal way to break a fast?
Really the best way is sort of for short fast is just to pretend like it never happened. So don't try to overthink it or overeat. We've all done it, of course. And then you get a stomach ache and then you learn, well, you should really just eat as normally as possible. So if you eat, you know, if you normally eat lunch, but you skip lunch, then try to eat that dinner, same time, same amount. Everything should be the same because you're trying to do is get your body to have taken the energy from your fat stores. For longer fasts, more than 24 hours, just make sure you do it very gently because you don't want to, again, all of a sudden overload the system and then you could get problems. A lot of people get sometimes diarrhea, sometimes stomach aches. You get all these issues. So you want to just be gentle with it. The longer you go, the more gently you should go. Under 24 hours, you should really just think about saying, hey, you know, just forget about it. about it. Just pretend like it never happened. Just take your regular meal at the next meal.
So you don't need to break it with a protein specifically. You don't have to be too mindful about it. You're just kind of breaking it with whatever it is you were going to eat. Other, obviously, like the protein or the fats or the foods that you were focusing on.
Exactly. And except for if you go longer, that is multiple days, then you should try and take it just much more gently.
Thank you very much for doing the interview today.
Okay, you're welcome. Thanks very much.
That was amazing. I loved hearing Dr. Fung talk about intermittent fasting and glucose and insulin and all of the hormones that are affecting us as we enter into perimenopause and menopause. If you enjoyed my conversation as much as I did, please share this interview because the more you share shows you care. And if you can leave a review letting me know how you're enjoying our Morphous for Menopause show, I would love to hear from you. As always, I appreciate your time. Thank you for watching. And remember that you've got this. I'll see you at the next interview.